The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Doris Hyde from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Vision News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The New Yorker, The Deafblind Community is Creating a Touch Language. From PetHelpful.com, a TikTok video has gone viral of a guide dog meeting his handler for the first time. From WRALSportsFan.com, Laurel Wheeler was back in Raleigh for the first round of the Canes-Boston Game 2. From The Sun, that's the-sun.com, scientists reverse deaths in eyes. From Bleeping Computer, QuickAssist is moving to the Microsoft Store, and they have a deal on a portable VPN and firewall. From PC Gamer, NVIDIA embraces open-source GPU drivers. So let's get started. Posted on NewYorker.com on May 12th by Andrew Leland, L-E-L-A-N-D, deafblind communities may be creating a new language of touch. ProTactile began as a movement for autonomy and a system of tactile communication. Now some linguists argue it is becoming a language of its own. When John Lee Clark was 5 years old in 1983, he entered a small deaf program within a public school near his home in Eden Prairie, Minnesota. Clark was a dreamy kid who dressed in tucked-in button-downs and pressed slacks. He came from a large deaf family. His father and brother are deafblind, his mother and sister are deaf and sighted, and the family had communicated in American Sign Language, or ASL, for generations. On Clark's first day of kindergarten, his mother, worried, followed his school bus in her car. When she surprised him at school to ask if he was okay, Clark said that he was fine, but that the bus driver had forgotten how to speak. His mother laughed and reminded him that the driver didn't know how to speak. She was hearing. This is a common story among deaf families, Clark told me recently. The gradual dawning that all those mutes could actually talk with one another, but in a very different way. In third grade, Clark began a bilingual deaf program. Instruction was in ASL, but students were grouped on the basis of their ability to read English, a second language that Clark accessed only in print. My literacy was abysmal, he said. He still has a workbook from that time in which he answered questions, what is your favorite sport? Who are the members of your family? With drawings instead of in English. But he was gifted in ASL, and teachers would ask him for help with tricky words. He sometimes pranked them by inventing ostentatiously elaborate versions. The word heaven is difficult for ASL learners, involving a precise looping of the hands. Clark added several gratuitous loops. At 12, Clark began attending a residential deaf school, many of whose students came from deaf families, but around this time he began to go blind. Hundreds of thousands of people in the U.S. have some combined hearing and vision loss, but most are older adults and have spent the bulk of their lives hearing and sighted. A much smaller group, about 10,000 according to some estimates, become deafblind earlier in life. A leading genetic cause is Usher syndrome. Clark, his father, and his brother have Usher, which can cause a person to be born deaf and to gradually go blind. At 14, Clark started to lose track of ASL conversations. I was this boy who always said, say again? Who might glide into you? Clark told me. So pathetic. He began reading in Braille, which his father had encouraged him to learn as a child, and started walking with a white cane. In high school, Clark stopped trying to follow ASL visually and began using tactile reception, feeling words with his hands. This helped, but miscommunication was common. ASL is a fundamentally visual language. The dominant hand gestures for the words stamp and fun, for instance, look very similar, except that stamp begins near the mouth, where fun starts at the nose. Yes or no questions are signified with raised eyebrows, and sentences can be negated with a shake of the head. When Clark would reply in ASL, he'd have no idea how the person was responding, or whether she was still paying attention at all. He said that it was like talking to a wall. He attended Gallaudet, a deaf university in Washington, D.C., with his future partner Adrian, a sighted deaf artist. It was really when I got married that I noticed more serious problems, he told me. He would come home from the store without the items that Adrian had requested and misunderstood the timing of their appointments. It'd blow up on me how that information in ASL had failed to register. On September 11, 2001, Clark went into a literature class at the University of Minnesota, where he was working toward his bachelor's degree. When he arrived, his interpreters made the hand shape for airplane and ran it into a raised finger twice. Clark interpreted this as an airplane hitting two poles and assumed that he was hearing about a local news story, perhaps about a hobbyist in a prop plane hitting telephone wires. It wasn't until he got home that he learned how much he must have missed. The tear-streaked faces, the TV footage running on loop. I heard remarkably similar stories about 9/11 and other cataclysmic news events from several deafblind people. In 2013, Clark attended a training in Minneapolis in ProTactile, a new movement that was encouraging deafblind people to reject the stigma in American culture against touch, which often leaves them cut off from the world around them. According to ProTactile's principles, rather than waiting for an interpreter to tell her about the apples available at the grocery store, a deafblind person should plunge their hands into the produce bins. If a sighted friend pulls out her phone in the middle of a conversation to check a weather alert, she should bring her deafblind interlocutor's hand to her pocket as well to understand where the weather forecast is coming from. ProTactile includes a set of practices to make tactile communication more legible. One of its creators, a deafblind woman named Jelica Nuccio, that's J-E-L-I-C-A-N-U-C-C-I-O, showed Clark how it worked. They sat facing each other, their legs touching, and Nuccio rested Clark's hand on her knee, explaining that as she spoke, he should tap to indicate that he understood, like nodding, a practice called back-channeling. Nuccio articulated words into Clark's hand, but also directly onto his arms, back, chest, and lower thighs. In ASL, pronouns are articulated as points in space. You might designate Minneapolis as the spot in the air near your left shoulder and Seattle as a spot near your right, and then those gestures stand in for the cities. Nuccio showed Clark how to indicate them as points on the body instead, a two-fingered press on each shoulder. It didn't feel like a lightning bolt moment, Clark told me. It was all too natural. But after the training, he noticed changes in his household. He and Adrian began using a ProTactile principle called co-presence. If she came into a room, she would brush him to let him know that she was there. Before, they'd sat around the table, and whoever sat next to Clark interpreted what the rest of the family said. Afterward, they began eating in informal clusters, allowing for tactile group conversations. In the years since, ProTactile has spread across the country. Today, most deafblind adults have heard of ProTactile's call to place touch at the center of their lives. Clark, who has become a leader in the movement, compared it to the Deaf Pride movement of his 1980s, when more deaf people began speaking ASL in public, insisting that hearing people gesture back. A few hundred people use ProTactile's communication practices daily, a very small group. Still, several linguists have come to believe that among some of its frequent users, ProTactile is developing into its own language, with words and grammatical structures that have diverged from those of ASL. I am totally convinced that this is no tweak of ASL, Diane Brentari, B-R-E-N-T-A-R-I, one of the premier linguists of sign language, who teaches at the University of Chicago, told me. This is a new language. Clark believes that ProTactile has the potential to upend centuries of deafblind isolation. It's an exciting time to be deafblind, he has written. The single most important development in deafblind history is in full swing. This past December, I met Clark in an old stone building that houses some of the University of Chicago's linguistic labs. Clark is tall with a youthful face. He lives with his partner and their three children, who are hearing and sighted, in St. Paul. He writes poems that are published regularly in Poetry magazine. He won a National Magazine Award in 2020 for a piece on tactile art and has both a poetry collection and a book of essays forthcoming from Norton. When we met, I was struck by the similarity between his presence in person and the way he comes across over email. In both, he is affectionately didactic. I had assumed that he would speak through my interpreter, but he insisted that he address me directly while she watched and translated so that I could experience the feel of ProTactile. I have a condition called retinitis pigmentosa, the visual component of Usher syndrome, which is causing me to slowly go blind. My hearing is unaffected. As Clark and I faced each other, our white canes leaning in a corner of the room, he kneaded my shoulders and instantly found my baseball cap, which I use as a sort of cane for my face. It saves me from slamming my head into open cabinet doors. Lots of people with Usher syndrome and RP will use these kinds of caps, Clark said. He playfully pulled it off my head and pressed it to my chest. If you want to up your game in protactile, he said, then what you're going to need to do is get rid of that cap and get your hands busy. The title of Clark's new poetry collection, How to Communicate, captures what has always been the central problem for deafblind people. Deafblind children living in linguistic isolation can spontaneously develop home signs that their immediate families understand. Laura Bridgman, B-R-I-D-G-M-A-N, who lost her sight and hearing to scarlet fever in 1830s New Hampshire, had signs for father, her hand drawn across her cheeks describing his whiskers, and spinning wheel, a rotating hand. But without a wider community, home signs can't grow into full languages. In 1837, the educator Samuel Gridley Howe recruited Bridgman to attend what would later be called Perkins, the first American school for the blind in Massachusetts. Howe had previously visited Hartford's American Asylum for the Deaf and Dumb, an incubator for what would soon emerge as American Sign Language, but dismissed signing as little more than pantomime. Instead, he and others at Perkins taught Bridgman to read and write English using raised letters, which she quickly mastered. He relentlessly publicized this achievement, and Bridgman became an international celebrity. 40 years later, Helen Keller's mother read Charles Dickens' account of meeting with Bridgman and reached out to Perkins, which sent a recent graduate, Annie Sullivan, to educate Keller. Sullivan fingerspelled English words into Keller's hands, hoping that she would slowly pick up the language the way infants pick up spoken language. The story of Keller's breakthrough, as her teacher placed her hand under a stream of water while fingerspelling W-A-T-E-R into the other, is a canonical scene in American history. There's a bronze statue of Keller at the water pump in the U.S. Capitol, and the moment was immortalized in the 1962 film The Miracle Worker. The miracle is Sullivan's feat of bringing language to a deafblind person, someone understood to be, as Howe described Bridgman, consigned to the darkness and silence of the tomb. Clark has no patience for this sacred image of Keller's deafblind epiphany. There was already a word for water, he said. Keller had developed dozens of home signs with her family before Sullivan arrived, for words such as ice cream, pretending to turn the crank of the freezer, then shivering, and bread. I would imitate the acts of cutting the slices and buttering them, Keller wrote. What Helen learned to do was to perform a stunt, Clark has written. Annie was attempting the equivalent of forcing Helen Keller to utter a pentasyllabic word whenever she wanted water. If you're thirsty, say ideology or specification or liability. In Keller's lifetime, other methods of deafblind communication arose. In public, Keller used the Tadoma method, in which she placed a thumb on the throat of her interlocutor and the rest of her fingers across that person's lips and jaw, a kind of tactile lip reading. There were several variations on an alphabet glove, printed with English letters so that a sighted person could tap out a message, but communicating letter by letter was cumbersome and slow. Today, some deafblind people communicate orally, many using hearing aids or cochlear implants, which usually only offer partial access to speech. Tactile sign language is also used, but issues with intelligibility remain. A 1995 study found that deafblind people understand as little as 60% of a sentence conveyed through tactile sign language. Various systems have been devised to improve tactile communication. In the 1990s, Trine Nass, N-A-S-S, a deafblind Norwegian woman, standardized haptics, a system of touch signals for common words, 11 for colors, 8 for drinks. For a time, some people were like, do you support haptics or PT? Clark told me. But you really cannot compare the two. It's not a Pepsi versus Coke situation, but Pepsi versus Cadillac. In 2005, Jelica Nuzio took over as the first deafblind director of Seattle's Deafblind Service Center, or DBSC, which offered social services to about 100 people in the region. 30 years earlier, a nonprofit called the Seattle Lighthouse for the Blind had established a program that employed deafblind people to do industrial work, and in the decades since, the city had become a kind of deafblind mecca. Nuccio is 57, with long dark hair and bright laugh. I was ready to move to Seattle and start a new chapter, she said. Nuccio had come to sign language late. As an adolescent, she attended a school in St. Louis that taught the oralist method, drilling deaf students in grueling exercises to learn how to read lips and produce speech. The nuns said, if you signed, you were stupid, she said. If you point at something in sign, you look like an animal. She learned ASL only in college at the Rochester Institute of Technology, yay, after her deaf classmates mocked her speech by using a derogatory word for oralism in ASL. Two horizontal forearms coming together like giant lips flapping, blah, blah, blah. In 1996, as Nuccio was becoming increasingly blind, she went to the Helen Keller National Center, a training facility on Long Island, but she felt that it was run like a prison. In the cafeteria, they immediately started shoveling food at me, she said. They weren't even communicating with me. I was in a feeding trough. I was like, I have degrees, people. A spokesperson for the center told me that for 55 years, thousands of deafblind individuals have benefited from HKNC's programs and added that its staff is knowledgeable, helpful, and kind. Nuccio was disappointed by what she found at the DBSC. Sighted employees and interpreters dominated life there. Blindness is enormously stigmatized in deaf culture, and many of the deafblind people at the DBSC, whom Nuccio called the tunnel vision people, clung to their dwindling eyesight, continuing to use visual ASL even as it grew difficult. The tactile people ate in a separate group at lunch and were treated with pity and condescension. Deafblind people often use interpreters to interact with the hearing-sighted world, but in Seattle they used them in deafblind groups too. Each client would speak to their own interpreter, who would repeat the message to other interpreters who would then relay it to their clients. I didn't understand why they would call Seattle the deafblind mecca when it was run that way, Nuccio said. Yes, there are a lot of deafblind people here, but so what? Why is that a mecca? Nuccio hired A.J. Granda, who is deafblind and had worked on and off for the DBSC. The pair recalled that the interpreter program at a nearby community college had posted a sign on the wall that said ASL Zone. When you entered the room, you agreed to abide by the rules of deaf space by turning off your voice. They decided to make the DBSC a deafblind-friendly zone, modeled on the same principle. But what were the rules of deafblind space? The first rule that they established came to be called airspace is dead space. Deafblind people at the DBSC were continually left out of ASL conversations among sighted people. Now, whether you were deafblind or not, all communication needed to happen in the realm of touch. Granda told me that their conversations with Nuccio had become so adapted to tactile reception that sighted friends could no longer follow them. To make tactile words even more expressive, the pair gradually expanded the canvas of touch to include back, arms, lower thighs, and the upper chest. Back channeling emerged to capture what ASL speakers communicate through facial expressions. A limp hand laid on the knee could signify exhaustion, and a tense grip might indicate terror. Everything was kind of clunky, and everyone was awkward with how we were using each other's bodies, Nuccio said. ASL was in the mix, and it was a mess. It was a great, messy start. Nuccio and Granda called their method pro-tactile, and within a few years they were holding trainings. But for the most part, the sight-reliant people were set in their ways. They often arrived, found a chair, and sat down, waiting for their interpreters. I said, if you need to know where anything is, you can ask a deafblind person, Nuccio said. She would take their hands, and together they'd touch the drinks and snacks. Nuccio and Granda encountered tremendous resistance among employees and clients at the DBSC. Deafblind people are oppressed by deaf people in the deaf community, Granda said. People who are oppressed tend to oppress others. Nuccio ended up firing much of her staff, including many of her friends, but she and Granda believed that they were developing a new political framework to achieve deafblind autonomy. So the pair hadn't set out to alter the linguistics of ASL, but as deafblind people in Seattle took ProTactile's methods home, words began to change in their hands. Granda said they realized ASL was no longer their language. The ASL word yes, for instance, is a fist bobbing in space like a nodding head. But by touch, it felt wrong. We knew what it meant because we knew the ASL word, but it was weird, Clark told me. A head rubbing itself against a wall? It did not make natural sense in contact space. The ASL word no, a two-fingered pinch, was similarly off-putting. It felt like an ostrich trying to pluck some hair off your head, Clark said. We never had a meeting to invent any new words. Life went on, and we had to say yes and no 1,000 times every day. In time, the community replaced these ASL words with words that felt more tactilely intuitive. Yes became an affirmative patting, and no felt like a hand swiftly erasing a message from a whiteboard. Those PT words are so simple, duh-worthy, so elegant, and they have absolutely no relation to ASL or the ASL words yes and no, Clark said. Not a shred in common. The ASL word vehicle is made with a hand turned to its side so that the thumb is like a driver piloting a craft through the air. By touch, all you can feel is a pinky grazing your leg. Over time, the protactile word became a flat palm driving across the lower thigh. And speakers developed ways of elaborating on these new words. Instead of describing the size of a vehicle in terms of how big it looks, Nuccio and Granda wrote, the tactile word can describe a vehicle in terms of how heavy it is, or how much friction it generates on the road, the features more relevant to touch. To signify a large vehicle, the speaker presses a flat palm down hard on the receiver's leg. For a compact car, she'd use a lighter touch. Some worried that protactile's intense tactile immersion could feel inappropriate, including to deafblind survivors of sexual or domestic violence, an objection that its creators have had to grapple with. Granda has taught protactile to numerous deafblind people whose prior traumas made them resistant to touch. We care about survivors and want to make sure that those people feel safe, Granda said, but they argued that anyone can feel comfortable and safe in protactile. There is a natural form of appropriate consent built into the language that with constant conversations actually can bring about healing, they said. By the early mid-2010s, protactile had evolved from a set of communication practices into a national movement. Granda and Nuccio made Braille bumper stickers, released videos, and traveled the country giving workshops and hosting PT happy hours, where locals could learn the basics. Nuccio and Granda eventually drifted apart, and Granda has spent time working at the Seattle Lighthouse and teaching protactile at CBEC, an annual deafblind retreat near the city. In 2014, Nuccio established an organization dedicated to protactile training called Tactile Communications. Around the same time, Clark joined the protactile movement and has led trainings that have reached hundreds of people. This past December, a half dozen of ProTactile's most fluent speakers met up at the University of Chicago. They had come at the invitation of Tara Edwards, a linguistic anthropologist who is studying ProTactile with her colleague Brentari, the sign language linguist. By visual standards, the lab had a drab provisional air. It was empty, aside from a haphazard scattering of metal folding chairs and a table pushed against a wall. But in deafblind space, this was a comfortable arrangement, ideal for generating ad hoc clusters of tactile conversations with no armrests or conference tables to separate people's bodies. Nearly all of the deafblind people were in stocking feet. You could read the rest on thenewyorker.com. I have spent way too much time on this article. Moving on to pethelpful.com, video of blind man meeting his guide dog for the first time has people in tears. Posted May 16th by Liz O'Connell. A blind man had a very special day when he got to meet his guide dog for the very first time. TikTok user at Paul Castle Studio shared a clip about his experience with meeting Mr. Maple. And it's the best thing we've seen in a long time. Based on the dog's reaction, it's hard to believe that this is the first time these two are meeting. In the clip, the creator was sitting down when Mr. Maple came running in to say hello. He had no idea how the introduction was going to go. We can't get over what Maple did after meeting his new best friend. Stop it, this is so cute. First of all, we love the name Maple. It is so fitting for this sweet, sweet pup. And second, they became instant best friends. They both just knew this was a match made in heaven. Maple was immediately like, "You are my person! No one else matters. He's so sweet," commented at Rachel K. They gave each other so much love already that we can't wait to see where this relationship grows. Let Maple warm up a little bit, as Maple is giving and asking for all the love, said at Chelsea Davis 110. LOL, Maple didn't need to warm up. He knew it was his human. So what happened after their instant connection? The two stayed and trained together in Oregon for 2 weeks before going home. Watch this video update of how Maple's training went and how he's doing with his new best friend and family. Aww. The creator said he'll be giving us more Maple content, and we are stoked. At Cara Marie said, "I've never clicked follow so fast. I need more Maple. LOL, we're right there with you." From WRALSportsFan.com, Blind Canes fan embraces sounds of the game in Raleigh and overseas, by Pat Welter. When people say there's nothing like seeing an NHL game in person, they really mean there's nothing like hearing it, too. Just ask Laurel Wheeler. Yay, let's go Canes, Wheeler yells from behind the boards as the Carolina Hurricanes take the ice for warm-ups. Wheeler is a native Texan, but she's in Raleigh for Game 2 of Carolina's playoff series with Boston. At this point, I've made so many friends among the Caniacs in Raleigh, Wheeler said. It's just so fun for me. It's important for me to come every time I'm in America. Wheeler has been working toward a master's degree in Russian studies at the University of Helsinki in Finland. Hurricanes hockey helped her learn the language abroad. So I thought, what can I do to help myself? I know hockey, Wheeler explained. I started Googling and YouTubing for NHL Finnish content, found a bunch from the Hurricanes, committed it all to memory, and I didn't understand the words at the time, but I was able to memorize it. So then, when we took our course and I started learning the words, I was able to figure out the pronouns, the verbs, all the different grammar, and I taught myself Finnish with it. Being able to speak a foreign language in another country is important, especially when you can't see. There's an advantage to being blind, Wheeler laughed. I don't need to pay for a TV subscription. I just listen to the radio. Wheeler was born blind. Her left eye is artificial and her right one is real. The way she explains it, her eyes didn't form all the way. I see light and dark, Wheeler said. So, for example, when I look back at the ice rink, I can see the white of the ice. I can see the lights up above. Wheeler became a Hurricanes fan during the playoff bubble of 2020. No fans in the stands helped her really pick up the sounds of the game. I was able to identify the different players by the sound of their skating stride, Wheeler said. Of course, that's now that there's fans and background noise, it's a little bit more challenging, but I know how to do it. Wheeler has a friend with her to help explain some visuals at the game. There's also her guide dog, Rota, R-O-U-T-A, who is decked out in Hurricanes gear. He loves getting up on the glass, Wheeler laughed, as she fed Rota a treat. Not only does Wheeler enjoy attending and listening to games, she's even started playing blind hockey in Finland. Instead of a puck, the sport uses a metal can filled with ball bearings, which helps the players locate it. When I play, I can't see the red line or the blue line, Wheeler explained. I just see the white, and when I'm skating, I know where I am because I can hear when I get closer to the boards. Some say seeing is believing. Wheeler lives life with the courage and faith. You will always succeed in life if you think creatively, if you think out of the box, and if you refuse to let anyone define you, Wheeler said. If I listened to what society told me I could do as a blind person, I'd be sitting at home in Texas doing absolutely nothing. I don't care what society thinks of me, and you can't either if you want to succeed. From the-sun.com, Scientists Reverse Death in Astonishing Feat by Bringing Dead Eyes Back to Life by Vanessa Chalmers, Digital Health Reporter. I'm going to have to abridge this because I don't have time. Eyes taken from organ donors 5 hours after death responded to light with electrical activity only previously seen in the living, recorded. The authors of the study said the discovery raises the question of whether brain death, as it is currently defined, is truly irreversible. The science demonstrated by the team could be used to study other tissues in the central nervous system, like the brain or the spine. Lead author Dr. Fatima Abbas said, "We were able to wake up photoreceptor cells in the human macula, which is part of the retina responsible for our central vision and our ability to see fine detail and color. In eyes obtained up to 5 hours after organ death, these cells responded to bright light, colored lights, and even very dim flashes of light." The rest of the article will be on The Sun. I've run out of time for today's episode of Vision News. Be sure to listen next week. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Doris Hyde, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Vision News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.